Well, thank you, everybody, for this opportunity to be able to address you, at least from the litigation perspective. And thank you, Cliff, for some of that really interesting stuff. I took some notes, and I Uh-oh. Was tempted to...
This is dangerous.
I was tempted to stand up and say, brief rebuttal, Your Honor, but I didn't know if it would... I don't know if you'd get it. And maybe you didn't. So am I the last speaker for today?
We have a Q&A.
For today. Oh, after Q&A. So I'm relieved and happy to know that I'm your the only thing stopping you from freedom. I appreciate that. So so Cliff mentioned early on in his discussion that he's tailored his documents toward the smaller companies, which I found, I think, exceedingly helpful. In my experience, it's actually the smaller entities where they have disagreements and there's often litigation. And I think that probably makes intuitive sense if you think about it, because these are generally individuals, you know, husband and wife and their friend. And, you know, people part ways, they go different directions, and therefore, next thing you know, you have litigation. The other thing I was going to mention, there's another point that you mentioned I thought was fantastic that I'll try to jump into as well. So I've been asked to talk about what we're talking about here, LLC agreements and partnership agreements, but from the litigation perspective, which I think is very helpful. I took an excerpt from, in preparing this conversation with all of you, I found an excerpt from this gentleman named Vincent Maritona. He's a New York attorney, and he wrote on this topic, and I thought that what he wrote was fairly prescient. And if I could, I'll just read you some portions of it, and forgive me for reading this straight to it, but I think it hits on some points here. He writes, "Transactional attorneys and litigators often take a very different approach toward contracts. Transactional attorneys focus on the ex ante, the relationship between the parties before there is a dispute. Sometimes their sole concern is making sure that the contract works sufficiently so that the deal gets done. More conscientious transactional attorneys weigh the various risks associated with contracts by regularly thinking about the what ifs. But transactional attorneys would do well to put on their litigator hats more often. Litigators think about what happens when things go south, when called upon to analyze a contract in the context of burgeoning litigation. Many litigators turn immediately to the, quote, boilerplate or, quote, miscellaneous provisions. That's where the contract interpretation and contract construction rules hide, which in addition to statutes, case law, and doctrine will inform the contract reader about how to interpret the provision at issue. But if principles of contract interpretation and contract construction are so important for assessing who, quote, unquote, wins in a dispute, then why do transactional attorneys too often neglect to consider them? One possibility is that formal training among transactional attorneys is lacking. Perhaps transactional attorneys bump up against occasional contract interpretation principles when analyzing a given contract, but we are rarely taught those principles in a systemic fashion. Another possibility is that transactional attorneys are focused on, quote, getting the deal done. They are viewing the contract as a manual for telling the parties what they can and cannot do, what they are or are not asserting as true. I'm going to stop there. It goes on, but I think this hits fairly well with the notion of what a transactional attorney does in the context of dealing with a contract, whether that's an LLC agreement or just any sort of contract. Generally speaking, and it's bizarre, right? I mean, most of us are attorneys here, and we take our general classes, but then we graduate, at least hopefully most of us, and then we specify. We become a transactional attorney generally or some sort of litigation attorney, and we never think about the other side. And that's important for us to think about the other side from time and again, because once the transactional attorneys, and as the author that I read to you, you know, they're focused on getting the deal done and making the parties happy. But once that occurs and the parties are happy, and then 2 years later something happens to where they're not happy, you know, how does that contract go through the ringer? And it's ironic, isn't it, if you think about it, that transactional attorneys don't often know what happens if it goes through the ringer. And at the same rate, to be fair, litigators don't know what's happening in terms of what the parties are doing and where everybody is at the time of contract formation. And so there most certainly is a contradiction and a discrepancy in terms of motivations and intent. So my first piece of advice generally is have a litigator read your documents. And I think that's fairly intuitive, but again, that goes to this notion of if you don't have kind of a buddy litigator, then find one. And I'm happy to be that one if you don't have one. But you know, when you have a provision or a contract that you don't know about or you have questions about, get advice from the other side and see how that's going to ring out. So that's my general advice. I'm going to talk about some kind of hot topics or things that I've seen in my experience as a litigator and give you some advice on that. So I'm going to talk about ambiguity, parole evidence, merger and integration clauses. So stay awake. So when construing a contract, a court's primary goal is to ascertain the intent of the parties at the time with respect to the provision at issue and at the time of contract formation. Okay? That's very important because courts now have to start engaging in that investigation to figure out what the intent was. And the question is, how do you do that? Well, the courts will read the contract. They'll read that contract as a whole to determine what purpose the parties had in mind when they signed it. And that really gets into, are we looking at parole evidence or are we looking otherwise? And if there is an ambiguity in the contract, then parole evidence can be used to determine the intent of the parties. If the contract is unambiguous, then the court should only look to the four corners of the contract. That's the four corners rule. I'm not doing a Uma Thurman Pulp Fiction thing.